You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For most of its history, the FBI's mission has been to help stop crime and prevent terrorist actions. But the way it has conducted business has often been controversial, at least since the time J. Edgar Hoover ran the agency. In recent years, FBI agents have been given the task of sniffing out white-collar criminals in the financial industry. Evan Ratliff has written a piece called The Mark for the current issue of The New Yorker that explores what happens when the relationship between FBI agents and their informants gets out of hand. And I'm very pleased it brings him to our studio today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Introduce us to the main characters in this story. Who is Michael Grimm, a.k.a. Michael Garibaldi and Mikey Suits?
So Michael Grimm was an FBI agent, and he worked a number of undercover cases. He worked cases against political corruption and corruption police forces, but his most prominent case was called Wooden Nickel, where he infiltrated Wall Street, and his cover was as a guy named Michael Garibaldi. And Michael Garibaldi ran a hedge fund. He was also a stockbroker. He had an office at the World Financial Center. And in that role, he was working with people who were doing illegal currency trades and other sort of fraudulent business on Wall Street.
So where do the other two main characters in the story you tell here come in? Joseph von Habsburg, is he really a German royalty?
So Joseph von Habsburg is sort of the central character of the story in that he was a guy who lived in New York for many years, and he sort of purported to be a descendant of Austrian royalty and a very wealthy family, and a lot of people knew him as that. He also happened to be working for the FBI at different times. He had actually worked for the FBI dating back to the 1980s in Detroit.
What does working for them mean? Was he a paid informant?
He was a paid informant. So he did a variety of things ranging from drug cases to counterfeiting cases back in Michigan. In New York, he was bringing mostly financial targets. So what he would do was he would bring someone to the attention of his FBI handlers and say, I've got a guy for you that he looks like he wants to launder money, or he looks like he's got a fraudulent stock business.
What was he doing so that he could even know whether somebody wanted to launder money?
Well, that's sort of one of the big questions. It's one of the big questions of confidential informants, that a good confidential informant is somehow immersed in the world of crime. They are able to access criminals and be exposed to them in a way that undercover agents can't as easily. And so von Habsburg he seemed to be encountering a good deal more malfeasance than the average person and bringing it to the attention of the FBI.
And he brought Albert Santoro to the FBI.
He did. So Albert Santoro was a lawyer. He was an assistant DA in the Queens, I think Brooklyn or Queens District Attorney's Office, and he was now in a solo practice. And Joseph von Habsburg met him at a nightclub and then brought him to the attention of the FBI and eventually handed him off to Michael Grimm, a.k.a. Michael Garibaldi.
And he's the man you call the Mark in your piece.
Right.
Is this case just one example of how the FBI does business?
Well, the FBI makes very extensive use of confidential informants. The Justice Department overall, they have a number somewhere north of 15,000 confidential informants at any one time. They pay them tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. And he was just one example of someone who he's sort of living out in the world and bringing things into the FBI, but he's not necessarily monitored closely. And so after he brought Albert Santoro to the attention of the FBI, he continued to meet with Albert Santoro, and he continued to tell him things like, according to Santoro, that he was going to make him wealthy, that he was going to make him part of his business. And so Santoro's meeting with the informant. He's also meeting with the FBI agent. But when his case finally comes down, which was for money laundering, the informant kind of disappears.
But he would say he was entrapped.
He would say that. His lawyers would say that. that's what they were. They claimed they were intending to argue. In the end, he actually ended up pleading guilty to a much lesser charge. But during the course of the case, which went over 4 years or so, their claim was that Joseph von Habsburg was working on behalf of the government, and he was sort of whispering in the ear of Albert Santoro during this whole process.
You seem to touch on a number of issues in this piece. What got you originally involved in even looking into these stories, and how did you come up with this story?
Well, the first thing that caught my attention actually in this story was way back in 2006, one of the defense investigators, a private investigator hired by Albert Santoro's defense team, was actually arrested here in New York. And he was accused of impersonating an FBI agent. The charges were later dropped. But that sort of brought that case to my attention initially. And then later I interviewed that same investigator and he brought up that this case was still ongoing. There were still aspects of it that were sort of outstanding and mysterious.
Well, you mentioned that the informants tend to be people close to or involved in criminal activity. Are most of them paid?
Well, not there are all variety of informants. So there are a category of informants that are I should say generally, it's not really known how many are paid and how many aren't paid. There are those that are paid. There are cooperating witnesses that are involved in the case itself, and they tend to testify. Informants tend to be people who bring information to an organization like the FBI. Often they are paid for that information. And then there are people who are sort of it's unknown what their motivations are. Their motivations may be, as some FBI agents thought of Joseph von Habsburg, just sort of a good Samaritan type character, or that they are looking for protection from the FBI. So they are committing their own crimes and hoping that by befriending the FBI, they'll get some benefits down the road.
Often they somebody's arrested for a minor crime. He then gives the name of somebody who's slightly higher up, and then in theory, you wind up going to the kingpin ultimately.
That's right. In a cooperating witness case, you might turn someone. So someone might be arrested. They would turn them. They would send them out with a wire on, and then they would bring back the higher up people.
Are the paid informants paid per crime or suspect, or are they put on retainers?
They can be paid in a variety of ways. They can be paid by a retainer. They can also be paid by a percentage of the proceeds of certain crimes, which is can be as much as 25% up to $500,000. Joseph von Habsburg was paid in a sort of unusual way, which was he was paid expenses while he was working for the FBI. So the FBI was paying for things like his child care and storage and portions of his rent. And so his case is not necessarily typical, I think, of how informants are paid.
A listener, Patrick from the Bronx, asks, are there more FBI informants than before? Do we know how many there are working for
FBI? We don't really know how many there are. If you look at FBI evaluations, even internal evaluations that have been declassified or made public, they tend to redact that information. The number 15,000 came out in a congressional hearing a couple of years ago, but generally they don't discuss confidential informants at all.
If an informant is working on a per crime basis, wouldn't that be an incentive for him to invent a crime or to at least make something look worse than it is?
Well, there are all sorts of tricky incentives when it comes to informants, especially ones who are paid, because they can have a sort of entrepreneurial approach. So if they bring someone to the attention of FBI, that can benefit them monetarily. So the FBI has all sorts of regulations that are supposed to deal with that issue. They have all sorts of internal handbooks that agents are supposed to follow and document very carefully and monitor very carefully their informants.
You note that informants, quote, like living in this mysterious world, but informants are hired based on their at least supposedly true identity, whereas agents have to take on a false identity. So whose world is more mysterious?
Well, I think the undercover agent's world is of course very mysterious, and someone like Michael Grimm had to work very hard to keep up his identity for over a long period of time, and it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. But someone like Joseph von Habsburg actually was sort of also living at the edge of identity because he had almost a triple life. His original name actually was Joseph Myers. He had changed his name to Joseph von Habsburg. He was acting the part of an Austrian prince, and he was also informing for the FBI. So he was kind of maneuvering all of these lives at the same time.
Is the FBI looking more and more into Wall Street? Is this a new area for them?
Well, I think they have had agents going in and out of Wall Street for years, and Operation Wooden Nickel, this particular case, it ended up with 50-plus arrests and mostly convictions for that. So they have been looking into it for a long time. I'm sure that there are ways that they're trying to get into Wall Street now, particularly after what's happened over the last few years.
There have been news reports over the years about agents forming close relationships and even friendships with their informants and protecting them when they probably should not have.
Well, that's the danger with an informant. An informant is helping an agent because they're bringing them information that can bring them big cases. And the more time they spend with that informant, the closer they get with them. And there are famous cases like the mobster in Boston, Whitey Bulger, who was actually tipped off to his own arrest by his agent, who was later prosecuted for that.
Are informants ever offered amnesty by the FBI for crimes they've committed? I know I spoke to somebody who told me that he was informing on Joe Colombo. This was many years ago. And as a result, whenever he committed a crime, and he committed quite a few, the FBI would just get him freed.
Well, there are dispensations that the FBI can offer for their informants that allow them to remain in the world of crime and continue to provide information. Those are supposed to be approved and documented, and they're supposed to only happen within the scope of a particular investigation. Now, someone like Joseph von Habsburg also benefited in that if he got arrested for something, his lawyer could go to the judge, as he did in one case that's on the record, and say, hey, this person is a cooperator for the FBI. They should get a reduced sentence. So he benefited in a variety of ways over the years in crimes that he actually committed.
Evan Ratliff is my guest. He's written a piece called The Mark for the current issue of The New Yorker that talks about the FBI and its informants. Does being in the FBI grant agents legal immunity?
Well, yes. I mean, if they're operating in the scope of an investigation, an undercover agent will often do things that they would not normally as a citizen be allowed to do. But that's part of
like selling drugs,
For instance, yeah,
or engaging in some illegal Wall Street deal.
Sure, like if they're trying to bust someone for currency trading, they may have to get fairly involved in illegal currency trading.
Well, in the case that you write about, who do you think was manipulating whom? Was Grimm manipulating his informant von Habsburg, or vice versa?
Well, Grimm, I should say, you know, his what he says is that he didn't really know von Habsburg very well. So von Habsburg was someone who handed off a target to him, and he didn't have a lot of time to vet the informant. So it's really about the relationship between the informant and his handler. And in that case, you have manipulation going in both directions. You have an informant who's essentially trying to con the FBI, and the FBI who's trying to get the most they can out of this person, get the most targets they can, and the most reliable targets that they can. And sometimes that sort of drifts into a situation where they're bringing people that maybe are not necessarily legitimate targets.
So the FBI agent can't always know whether he's being deceived by his informant.
Yes. In fact, one FBI agent put it, you know, he said you don't get good informants out of a monastery. And so an informant by their very nature is a con man, because they're conning either you or they're conning their associates or both. So by nature, they're lying to you. And the question is, are they lying to you in a way that's going to, you know, be detrimental to the case?
You note that the FBI brings in tens of millions of dollars for the government in fines and settlement fees from accused suspects. Does this represent an ulterior motive or a reason for the FBI to get engaged in this sort of thing?
Well, I don't think it's financial in some way. I think it's just FBI agents want to bring big cases. That's what they do, and that's what they're paid to do. And an informant that can help them do that is always going to be very valuable. The incentive on the other side may in fact be purely monetary, that the informant, if they bring in a big case and they know they can get a percentage of what's confiscated, then that's a strong incentive for them to take this entrepreneurial approach.
My guest is Evan Ratliff, whose reporter-at-large piece in the current issue of The New Yorker is called The Mark. The FBI needs informants, but what happens when they go too far? We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. But before we go to the break, I thought you should know that the National Weather Service's tornado warnings for Passaic, Rockland, and southeastern Orange, northwestern Essex, and northwestern Bergen counties has expired. WNYC will continue to keep you updated as the storm system moves through our area. Stay with us for more. We're back with Evan Ratliff, whose article in the current issue of The New Yorker is called The Mark, The FBI Needs Informants, But What Happens When They Go Too Far? And a listener wonders if the FBI agent that we've been talking about, Michael Grimm, is the same one as the Republican congressman who represents Staten Island and Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
Indeed, he's the same.
So what happened? He's now on the House Financial Services Committee?
That's right.
Did he run as an anti-crime candidate?
He didn't run largely on crime issues, although he did. His FBI background was a large part of his campaign.
But your piece brings up some questions about the integrity of his work with the FBI. Did you talk to him? Is he concerned about whether this will have a negative effect on his career?
I did talk to him. I interviewed him three separate times. I can't speak to whether he's concerned about his career, but
well, did he deny what you were writing?
He there were some aspects of the story that he disagreed with the way witnesses had portrayed events that had happened, and we included his response in the story as well.
The abuse of authority and power is a theme throughout this article. Do you feel that it's possible to clean up the FBI, or are these kinds of crime webs built into the system?
Well, I think if you're going to be using confidential informants very extensively, as the FBI does and will continue to, I mean, the assistant director a few years ago said it, that informants are the lifeblood of the FBI, you're always going to run into these problems. And in fact, they issued new regulations concerning confidential informants back in 2001, 2002, and then they evaluated how those regulations were holding up in 2005, and they found some sorts of violations in 90% of the cases with confidential informants. So it's just an inherently fraught human relationship.
And do they consider it a necessary evil?
I think they do. I think they do. And I think they try to train the agents and to instruct the agents and to get good agents who know how to handle confidential informants. And probably most of the time, it works out well, and they prosecute the crimes they're looking to prosecute.
Hey, you start off by saying Albert Centura was kind of set up for this whole thing, but he did admit to a crime, and should we feel all that sorry for him?
Well, I think, you know, he pled guilty to a federal crime. So, you know, that's something that is on his record and he'll have to confront. But at the same time, I think it's worth looking at how that process came about. Because when the federal government indicts someone, it's a very, very powerful tool. And once you're indicted, it's very, very difficult to defend yourself. And 90% of federal indictments end in either a guilty plea or a prosecution or a conviction. So I think that looking back at how this all came about and how he was brought to the attention of the FBI in the first place is valuable. And I think there are aspects of that that are sympathetic to his situation.
In reporting this story, do you run into the same kinds of secrecy issues that you would if you were talking about foreign policy? Or CIA operations?
I did. Maybe not that secretive. I think a lot of people are willing to talk, but not for attribution if they've worked for the FBI or they're involved in a case. And Joseph von Habsburg, his identity had been revealed in a court case. So I could pursue his background, and private investigators had pursued his background. So that was a little bit easier. Normally, a confidential informant, their identity has not been revealed. And that's sort of the first hurdle to even talking about this issue.
Was he open with you?
He was not. He actually is in prison in Michigan now. He was arrested and convicted on back child support payments that he owed in Michigan. So I did talk to him a couple of times, but he was not open about his past.
Can you talk about his storied past? What did you find out?
Well, he has lived quite an interesting life. He grew up in Michigan. His name was Joseph Myers. And he started getting into trouble with the law when he was a teenager. He was actually forcibly confined to a mental institution. He was arrested for auto theft and forgery. And then in the mid-80s, he actually just approached the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, in Detroit and said, I want to inform on drug dealers. I've been working for drug dealers. And they took him on as an informant. He sort of cold called the DEA out of nowhere.
Is that typical?
Well, I think that it's typical for people to approach if they think that they can get out of a crime that they're committing, or they think, you know, the heat is coming down on them. It's not clear if that was his situation, but he set up a drug bust for the DEA, and then he switched over to the FBI and claimed that he wasn't getting paid enough by the DEA.
And when did he change his name from Meyer to – he legally changed it to von Habsburg, didn't he?
In the early 90s, he had said previous to this that to people around him, including his wife, that he was a descendant of royalty in Europe, and he changed his wife. He and his wife both changed their name to von Habsburg. Lothringen was the last name that they used.
Did you ever worry that people were giving you false leads in covering this story?
I did. I reported the story for more than a little more than 14 months, and during the process, I did at least 100 interviews, and a lot of it was sort of going from one source to the other and trying to double check one against the other. Of course, these are issues that, you know, people don't necessarily want to talk about, so it's a little harder to dig up the information and to go check it and make sure that it's right.
Well, what should we take away from this story, that the FBI engages in some activities that we should not be proud of?
I think that it's
Is it illegal?
It's not necessarily illegal. I mean, certain aspects may be in violation of FBI policy. But I think it's more that we should be aware that the way that cases are made and crimes are prosecuted often involves these informants, and that we should take a close look at who the informants are and how they're being used and how they're being monitored.
Well, there's also the matter of other people who are brought into the story. There are judges who, with good connections, who people claim to be friends of. After a while, you begin to wonder whether everybody isn't on the take on some level.
Well, there were a lot of people who were friends with Joseph von Habsburg and acquaintances of Joseph von Habsburg and sort of pseudo-business associates of Joseph von Habsburg who believed that he was royalty, that he was worth $1 billion. So when you go around telling people you have tens of millions of dollars, sort of relatively easy to get them into your circle somehow. So he was using those people as leverage to get to other people.
And he dressed quite well, you say. So where did he get the money to do all of that, just from being an FBI informant?
He got paid some money by the FBI. There are some documented crimes that he committed that resulted in financial benefit for him. His wife also said that he took stocks from her father, that he were part of his pension, his retirement, and he used those. And then aside from that, it's a little bit mysterious how he was able to afford such an extravagant lifestyle. He lived in an $8,000 loft in Soho for many years.
You have to wonder whether these are the kind of people we want our government getting information from. But what did this mean for you when you started covering the story? Did you ever feel threatened?
No, I didn't. I felt like I was encountering people who I had to spend a lot of time to persuade to talk. But I never felt threatened, and I never felt that, especially later in his informing career. Joseph von Habsburg was involved with mostly financial crimes, and he was bringing these sort of white collar crimes to the attention of the FBI.
Well, how do judges deal with this? Do they see these as entrapment cases?
Well, entrapment is very hard for a defendant to prove, especially when it involves a confidential informant, because you have to prove that you were incited to commit the crime by the government, and then it's sort of an open question as to whether or not the informant can really be the person to incite you to commit the crime.
But the way you tell the story here, Albert Santoro entered this thing quite innocently. He was a guy who was looking for work, and he was enticed with all sorts of promises. And eventually he started playing the game he thought he was expected to play.
Yeah, he was someone, I would maybe hesitate to use the word innocent. He did plead guilty, but he was someone who got wrapped up with this informant and believed the informant's promises, and also believed the informant telling him that he and the undercover agent, they were just sort of trading boasts. That's kind of what he got wrapped in, with boasting that he could do these things that he could never do.
Cy Hirsch, when he talks about how he gets his stories from the CIA, lets it be known that there are an awful lot of people in that agency who are upset with the way things are run, but we'll talk to him off the record. Did you find similar things with the FBI?
I did find people who were willing to talk off the record.
Are there people at the FBI who are concerned about the way they deal with these informants?
Sure. I think people who handle informants directly are concerned about it and try to be as careful as possible with it. And there were certainly people who I heard from who were concerned about this case and concerned about the way the informant was used in this case and the way that the informant may have sort of manipulated the government in a way to protect himself.
Are you, I know this is a personal question, but are you happy with the idea that Michael Grimm is now on the House Financial Services Committee?
Well, he's not the congressman for my district. So in terms of his role in Congress, that's for his constituents to determine what they're happy with, I suppose.
Evan Ratliff's article, The Mark, the FBI needs informants, but what happens when they go too far, is in the current issue of The New Yorker. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.